Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record, program number 1037, interview number 7 with Jim DiEugenio about Destiny the Trade. This is being recorded on December 4th of the year 2018. And let me remind you that we are into December. This is holiday gift giving season. And this book, the focal point of our discussions that we've had and the discussions to come, Destiny Betrayed, will make a marvelous gift, as would JFK The Evidence Today. Once again, it is my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airwaves Jim DiEugenio, as mentioned, the author of Destiny Betrayed, and also JFK The Evidence Today. Jim, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Good evening, Dave.
Last week we wound up, very close anyway, to the end of the program, talking about one of George de Morenfield's colleagues in the oil business and also in the intel business, George H.W. Bush. And, of course, this past week, Bush passed away, and we have been subjected to 24/7 hagiographies about what a wonderful guy he was, and he wasn't divisive, and this, that, and the other thing. In the introduction or a preface to Destiny Betrayed, your associate Lisa Peace had some appropriate comments. She, and I'm paraphrasing here, but she spoke of the JFK assassination and the official version of it as almost being a kind of sorcery. It is, of course, the official version is a big lie. And she observed correctly that when someone has read your book, they will not be subject to that sorcery or devilry, that big lie again. And I think for some listeners who may be wondering about when I'm going to cover all of the other things that are going on in the world, and there is a great deal that is, I think we can extend what Ms. Peace observed correctly beyond the JFK assassination to events as a whole. You speak, Jim, in your book about some of the volunteers who assisted Jim Garrison. One of those, of course, was one of my role models, and that is the brilliant political comedian Mort Saul. And in his autobiography, Mort Saul mused, he asked, how many lies can you allow yourself to believe before you belong to the lie? And that is something that I think reflects or radiates from the JFK assassination and the reality of it, as you have revealed, not only to the official version of the JFK assassination, but to so many of the official lies. And I think what Lisa Peace observed correctly about what your book does in terms of allowing us to dispel or penetrate the official big lie, I think extends way beyond that to other official lies. As Mort Saul observed, how many lies can you allow yourself to believe before you belong to the lie? And I think, frankly, I'm extremely pessimistic. I think America does belong to the lie or to the lies. And I think the orgiastic, effusive rhetoric around George H.W. Bush really reflects that.
Yeah, I kind of agree with that. I mean, to give you George H.W. Bush, well, you probably know this, really began his political rise under Nixon and Ford, all right? And under Ford, he actually became the director of the CIA at a very opportune time, because it was Bush and Ford, with some help, some other people like David Phillips, who were intent on crushing the Church Committee and the Pike Committee. If your listeners, I know you know what those two were, but if some of your listeners don't know, those were the two congressional committees, the Church Committee in the Senate, the Pike Committee in the House, who were investigating the crimes of the intelligence community in the mid-70s, all right? And it was one of the things that Bush did was to essentially declare war on both the Church Committee and the Pike Committee. Another thing that Bush did as a director of the CIA is, and again, I'm sure you know this, I'm not sure about your listeners, that he sponsored something called Team B. Team B was a creation of a committee called the Committee on the Present Danger that thought, and this is a very important point, that the CIA was underestimating the Soviet threat. So, and I think this is the first time it ever happened, although it's going to happen later under Cheney, okay? Bush allowed a private team of experts to go in, go through the material, and say that the threat is much bigger than we ever dreamed. And that, of course, Bush allowing them to do that, because these guys were actually to the right of the CIA, okay? That was the excuse then for when Reagan came to power, the almost obscene defense buildup that he authorized, which, of course, we know today, a little bit too late, it was all a bunch of bullshit because it completely exaggerated, you know, what the Soviet Union did have, all right? The Soviet Union today is barely in the top 10 for defense expenditures, all right? So those are the kind of things that George H.W. Bush was about, and those are the things that he did, you know? And so I agree with you. You know, it's sort of like the reverse of what Mark Anthony said with Julius Caesar. I think Mark Anthony said, you know, the evil that men do live on, the good is buried with their bones. Well, with this guy, you know, the little good that he did do is living on, and all the evil he did is buried in his gravesite, you know.
and we should mention that one of the things that the elder George Bush helped to crush was any objectivity on the part of the House Select Committee on Assassinations.
Yes.
And it was under Bush that George Joannides, whom we spoke about in our last talk, was made the liaison between the CIA and the House Select Committee on Assassination, which was a classic case of appointing a fox to watch the hen house.
Right.
And we should also not lose sight of the fact that Gerald Ford, who appointed Bush, was a key member of the Warren Commission.
Of course, right.
And so it is a pedigree of evil, a pedigree of treachery that stretches back for many years. And, of course, the Soviet Union is long gone, but Russia, again, is nothing like the U.S. in terms of military expenditure or capabilities. And yet, we are hearing now with the new Cold War, which is an interesting subject in and of itself.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
Jim, exaggerating exponentially the Soviet Union's capabilities and intentions, and now Russia's as well, really is something that was institutionalized with something you speak about in the introduction or in the early part of Destiny Betrayed, which is Alan Dulles from Sullivan and Cromwell and his incorporation of Hitler's entire intelligence apparatus, the Reinhard Gehlen outfit, which William Corson, who was a former Marine Corps colonel, who was the advisor, the intelligence advisor to the Church Committee, what he termed in his book, The Armies of Ignorance, a front for Odessa Nazis. It was riddled with the most egregious SS people, and they gave a wildly exaggerated report, or quote, intelligence, unquote, on what the Soviets were capable of doing and what they intended to do. One of the books that you speak about, you list in your bibliography, Blowback by Christopher Simpson, points out that it was just what many of the defense contractors wanted to hear. And something that was adjunct to, part and parcel to the Galen organization was the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, formerly the Committee of Subjugated Nations, one formed by Adolf Hitler in 1943. And that was a consortium of Eastern European fascist organizations, the Ukrainian OUNB, the Bulgarian National Front, the Romanian Iron Guard. And in our last talk, we began, or rather we discussed, we highlighted Spaz Rakin, who met Oswald upon his return from the Soviet Union. And as we transition into Oswald's handling in the U.S., it might be a good thing, I think, for you to recap for us who Spaz Rakin was and the real significance of a guy like that meeting someone who was a, quote, traitor, unquote.
All right. And going ahead and reviewing what we did at the end of the last show, Oswald and his wife, Marina, land in Hoboken, New Jersey. All right. And this is June of 1962. And they're met by a guy named Spaz T. Rakin of the Travelers Aid Society. Now, Rakin had been contacted by the State Department to aid the Oswalds when they got back into the United States. But as you indicated, Rakin was also a former secretary of the American Friends of Bolshevik Nations, an anti-communist lobby with extensive ties to the CIA and other intelligence agencies. He helped them apply for a federal loan and took them to a hotel in Times Square, all right? And from there, of course, they're on their way back into the heart of Texas. But as we're going to see, that meeting with Rakin, okay, and his very murky and suspicious background, why would the State Department want this particular guy, to meet Oswald there? Okay, this is only going to be a foreshadowing, all right, of what's going to happen when Oswald gets to Texas, because it gets even more bizarre when he gets into the Dallas-Fort Worth area, because he begins to ingratiate himself through people like Peter Gregory, through people like George Buhe, through people like George Bornschild, with something called the White Russian Community in Dallas-Fort Worth, which is bizarre, even on its surface, because here you have this spectacle of Lee Harvey Oswald, the Marxist Marine, who defects to the Soviet Union, stays there for 2.5 years, brings back a Russian wife, all right, and the whole time has been more or less endorsing the Soviet way of life, is now going to hook up with the White Russian community in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, who are dedicated to overthrowing the communist regime in Moscow. And I'm telling you, when you read the Warren Report about this, okay, the way they paper it over, is really, they never even acknowledge the paradox, okay? But when Oswald does get back to Dallas-Fort Worth, all right, he goes ahead and he meets up with a guy named Peter Gregory, all right? Peter Gregory worked in the library, was a translator, of the Russian language into English, and Peter Gregory becomes a very good, well, not a very good friend, but an acquaintance of both Marina and Lee. Lee, is his pretext is that he's going to be writing a book about his experiences in the Soviet Union, all right? Gregory invited the Oswalds to his house for dinner and introduced them to a guy named George Buhe. Now, George Buhe is really, when you study this group of people, this white Russian community in Dallas-Fort Worth, he was really more or less the leading light and the secretary of all their activities in their area, all right? See, they were sponsored by something called the Tolstoy Foundation, which was another CIA front, and they kept extensive records on all of their activities, what they were doing. And Buhe was a secretary in charge of their records, all right? All right, now, some of the other people that Oswald gets introduced through George Buhe, all right, Anna Miller, who happened to be born in Russia, Declan Ford, a consulting geologist, and his wife, Catherine, Alina Hall, who was also of Russian parentage, and to Max Clark and his wife, Katia. Max was a retired Air Force colonel and former security officer for General Dynamics.
A huge, by the way, a huge defense contractor, part
and
parcel.
Yeah, you're talking one of the top five. Yeah, right, definitely.
And his wife was an interesting creature. We talked about last night.
That was the punchline.
Yeah.
His wife was born Princess Shcherbatov, a member of the Russian royal family. Now, come on, how absurd can you get, okay? You know, I mean, if you could very easily, you know, do a Saturday Night Live skit about this, okay? These two poor communists were being introduced to all these Russian people who have their ambition in life is to bring down Khrushchev and return the Tsar to power, okay? So this is just ridiculous, if you ask me. And if the Warren Commission never even tried to get to the bottom of it, shows you, you know, just what a bunch of stiffs they were on that commission.
And we should mention, too, that this group is inextricably linked not only with CIA and the intelligence community, but with the milieu that was embodied in Stasraken and the ABN.
Right.
So that the transition from the guy who was their landing party, Commodore, so to speak, to this crew is a very smooth one indeed, as you noted.
See, Dave, the group that they were linked to ideologically, you probably heard of this group. They were called the Solidarists.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, you probably know a lot about that. Okay. All right. And it was a very, very murky, very reactionary, the Solidarists were, about, you know, uniting all the people in Eastern Europe, not just the Soviet Union, okay, but to create a kind of group in the United States that if and when we overthrew those governments in the Eastern Europe, that they would be the people who would go in and take them over. That's how reactionary, that's how right-wing these people were.
Absolutely.
You know?
And both the Solidarists and the ABN have direct links to the Nazi spy apparatus that we have spoken about so often on this show. So that when we have the supposed Marxist Marine and traitor Oswald coming back with that very interesting new Russian wife, Marina Prusakova, who quite obviously, as you pointed out in your book, and we highlighted in our last talk, was almost certainly an intelligence officer herself. You know, it makes no sense whatsoever on its surface, because the discontinuity could not be more fundamental or more dramatic, and yet it makes all the sense in the world if we look on Oswald as a in his supposed communism, Marxism, treason, as nothing but a cover, and we'll proceed from there. One of the people that you mentioned, Jim, who was tasked with making the introduction of the Oswalds to this remarkable group of people in the Dallas area. And perhaps we should mention that many of them had links to the petroleum industry. And that was someone we spoke about last week. We will talk about again now, and someone to whom we will return when we talk about the House Select Committee, George de Morenfield. Tell us more about him.
Well, talk about a paradox, all right? George de Morenfield was born in the USSR of an upper-class family. His father was a marshal who served as both the Tsar's governor of Minsk and also the director of the Nobel oil interest there before the revolution, all right? So in other words, if there hadn't been a revolution, the de Morenfield family would have been incredibly wealthy, all right? So sometimes the nickname given to George was the Baron, okay? He came to America in 1938, spent a summer on Long Island, where he actually met the mother of Jackie Kennedy, the Auschwitz family. He was an oil geologist and member of the Dallas Petroleum Club, who was acquainted with the man we were just talking about, George H.W. Bush. That acquaintance was through a man named Eddie Hooker, who the Baron had partnered with in an oil investment firm. Hooker was Bush's former classmate at Phillips Academy in Andover, Massachusetts. All right. Now, de Morenfield had a very, I think most people would have to say, you know, a very strange life. He was married something like four times, all right, and his job was supposed to be an oil geologist, but he really kind of traded on that with the intelligence community. And he was accused of working for more than one intelligence community. He was accused of working for the Nazis. He was accused of working for the Russians. All right. He was even accused of working for the French. All right. But by about 1957, he had become friends with a guy named J. Walton Moore. J. Walton Moore was a Dallas CIA station chief. All right. And J. Walton Moore tried to disguise his relationship with George de Morenfield, saying that he only met him twice, but that ended up being a lie because they were such good friends that de Morenfield would have him over to his house and he would be over at J. Walton Moore's house.
And again, right? J. Walton Moore is basically presiding over CIA operations in Dallas, and he is
right.
Sort of the prime mover in directing de Morenfield towards the Oswalds.
Correct, correct. And it later turned out that, you know, Jim Garrison was one of the very first people to note this strange relationship between somebody like de Morenfield and somebody who's supposed to be, you know, a Marxist-Leninist like Oswald. Right. And it always struck many people as being rather odd. Right. And so it turned out that de Morenfield finally admitted, you know, that, look, I would have never met Oswald in 1,000 years if it hadn't been for J. Walton Moore asking me to go ahead and meet the guy. All right. So in other words, it was a CIA that told de Morenfield to go ahead and meet this guy, right? All right, which is, I think, a very, very interesting revelation, all right? And so Because the obvious question is, why? Why would the CIA want De Morenschild to go ahead and meet with Oswald? You know? And I think the answer to that question, as we go ahead and examine it, is that as many people have concluded, including myself and probably you also, you know, that De Morenschild was more or less going to be Oswald's babysitter for several months through 1962 and early into 1963. He even supposedly arranged for a job for Oswald. First, Oswald worked at a welding shop, and then De Morenschild was supposed to have gotten him a job at something called Jagger's Child Stovall. All right? Now, this one, getting him a job at Jagger's Child Stovall, is really, really, really bizarre because of a couple of things, okay? First of all, Oswald met a guy named Dennis Ofstein there who spoke a little bit of Russian. And Ofstein said Oswald told him some of the most interesting things about his observations in Minsk, about the whole tank formations outside of the city, about the fact that he didn't see a plane with any jet vapors there. You know, so obviously Oswald was doing some spying on, I mean, when I go on vacation, I don't look for those kind of things. Okay, so, but that's what he was doing there. And then he also explained to Ofstein a couple of techniques that he had learned. One of them was called typography, and the other one was microdots, all right? Typography is a sophisticated technique of photographic reduction used by Jagger Child Stovall in its advertising work. A microdot is a method employed in espionage to reduce large amounts of printed information photographically down to the size of, for example, a period at the end of a sentence, all right? That dot is then passed on in the text of a letter or a document to who you want to get the information to. Now, obviously, if Oswald was sophisticated enough to know about all that stuff, you have to be at least suspicious that he was involved in some kind of espionage work, all right? Now, something else that is kind of interesting is that Jagger's Child Stovall was one of the weirdest companies you could imagine to be employing a communist, all right, because they handled work for the U.S. Army Map Service, all right? In other words, they also did map charts for U-2 flights over Cuba.
And right? Review for us very briefly what we spoke about in previous interviews about Oswald and the U-2, because this is, again, something on its surface is beyond incredible. It is stunning, and yet when seen in the larger context of all these white Russians and the anti-Castro Cubans and so forth, it makes only too much sense.
Right. We had seen earlier where Oswald was in the service. He was transferred to Atsugi, which is a base in Japan, which at that time was the more or less the home of the U-2 in the Pacific, all right? And Oswald, one of his assignments was to actually guard the U-2 at the Atsugi Air Force Base. All right, then when he defects to the Soviet Union, the U-2, which most people had considered to be unhittable, was actually shot down on the Francis Geary Powers flight while Oswald was there. And he had actually threatened to the embassy, and the American embassy in Moscow, that he might give away secrets to that. Well, now you have Oswald at this map place in Dallas-Fort Worth, which is actually doing charts for the U-2. I mean, can this all be a coincidence? I don't know. Maybe. All right. But it sure doesn't sound that way to me. All right. Okay. So Now, also, there was also rumors that some of the maps used during the Cuban Missile Crisis were also made up at Jagger's Child Stovall. So as many people have said, what kind of security did they have at that place? You've got this communist guy walking around talking about topography and micro dots, you know, and Soviet tank arrangements and vapor trails. And he's also working at a place that charts U-2 flights and does maps for the Cuban Missile Crisis. All right, so a lot of people believe that, I'm sorry, I just don't buy it, okay? You know, why would De Morenschild get a guy a job, like a guy like that, a job at JCS, all right?
Of course, and someone who was not only an avowed Marxist slash communist, but a would-be traitor who had disclosed to his ideological comrades, if we take it at face value, information about the very grouping of projects that was extant in the Jagger's Child Stovall operations.
Right. So now, what happens next is that Oswald now goes ahead, and two things happen. De Morenschild leaves the Dallas-Fort Worth area in the spring of 1963 to go to Haiti, where the United States is going to try and overthrow the Duvalier regime, the brutal Duvalier regime. All right, and he's going to become friends with a guy, Clement Charles, who is one of the guys who wants to do it for the CIA. So De Morenschild is now going to move off stage, but not before he introduces Marina and Lee to a couple called Ruth and Michael Payne. Now, one of the things that I'm most proud of about this book, Destiny Betrayed, the second edition, is that I was in a position to use a lot of work that was done for a journal that I edited along with Lisa Peace called Probe Magazine in the 90s. And we published a lot of work by a woman named Carol Hewitt and a guy named Steve Jones, all right? And they did, especially Carol, some remarkable research on Ruth and Michael Payne, all right? And I thought that these two people, their backgrounds had not been very much explored, you know, by previous researchers. To give you an example, once De Morenschild arranged a meeting between Ruth and Marina, very soon it becomes pretty obvious that Ruth is trying to separate Marina from her husband. In fact, as I note in my book, within about a month, she writes Marina a letter, which she said she didn't mail, in which she invites Marina to move in with her. Okay? I mean, this is after you met somebody three times, you know, for a period of about 1 month, and you invite them to move in with you. Okay? Now, why is that so important? Because although she did not succeed at this time, later on, she is going to succeed in separating Marina from Lee. And that's a very, very important element, I believe, in what is going to happen to Lee Harvey Oswald. All right? So then she's instrumental when Marina and Lee move to New Orleans Lee goes first, and it's Ruth who then drives Marina to New Orleans, okay? And then she returns back to her home in Irving, which is a suburb of Dallas, and keeps up a written correspondence with Marina, which lasted through the entire summer, all right? All right. Now, another interesting thing that happens is that that summer, Ruth Payne begins a traveling tour by car around the country, visiting friends and relatives, all right? And she keeps up this correspondence with Marina, all right? And then she decides to stop in New Orleans on her way back home, stays there for about 3 days, all right? And she actually is the person who drives Marina back to Dallas so she can deliver Oswald's second child, all right? Now, what's so interesting about this is that although it seems like it was impromptu or willy-nilly, when the FBI interviewed Ruth's friends and family, Ruth told everybody that she was going to pick up a Russian woman in New Orleans and bring her home to live with her in Irving. So in other words, Dave, it seems planned. That was her objective, okay? So I think that was something that was very, very interesting and that had not been brought to the surface, okay, until my book came out. But inevitably, by September the 27th, Marina was living with Ruth while Oswald is allegedly in Mexico City, and Michael Payne, her husband, is giving Marina financial support, all right? Now, when Oswald finally does get back, allegedly, from Mexico City, all right, the job he gets at the Texas School Book Depository was partly arranged for by Ruth Payne, and Oswald does not stay with the Paynes at this time. He gets a rooming house, so he's now separated from his wife, okay, at the time of the JFK assassination, while his belongings, and this is an important part of the story, while his belongings have been driven back to Irving, Texas, in the station wagon of Ruth Payne, and they are now in the garage of Ruth and Michael Payne. All right? Now, that is going to be very, very, very important and very interesting as the story progresses. All right, but that gives you a little preview of why the Paynes and also the relationship with the Mournchild, because it really does seem, when you examine it, that, as many people have said, it was almost like De Mournchild was passing off Lee and Marina to Ruth and Michael Payne. And we must also never forget, as De Mournchild always said, I would have never met Lee Oswald if it wasn't for J. Walton Moore asking me to. All right? So I think that gives the listener out there a really good background, bedrock background, into the very, very odd milieu that Lee Harvey Oswald finds himself, you know, in the spring of 1963 in Dallas-Fort Worth.
Jim, in your book, and I think it is one of its strongest suits, you go into the family pedigree of the Paynes. Now, bear in mind that these are the people who have been involved in what Jim has laid out. It is Ruth Payne who gets Oswald his job at the Texas School Book Depository. And remind me, Jim, if we don't come back, if I don't mention it, we should come back to the fact that he had a better offer at that time.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
But the Paines, supposedly Quakers, peace-loving liberals, have an extensive pedigree on both sides of the family that is altogether remarkable. And Jim, I'd like you to set that forth for us, because I think it will place the actions of the Paines and their interactions with both Lee and Marina Oswald in a much deeper and more relevant and important context.
Okay. One of the things that is so interesting about the Paines, you know, is that they were dismissed as being simply kindly Quaker people who were sort of like good Samaritans, all right, doing a favor to this poor Russian couple, all right? Well, I'd like to say that that is the real story, but it turns out that that's kind of a fairy tale. You know, sort of like George de Morningchild that ended up being a fairy tale. I mean, I'll give you an example. George de Morningchild, his brother Dmitri, actually did work for the CIA. And in fact, he was quite close friends with Alan Dulles, and Dulles helped him publish something called Russian Review during the 50s and 60s, all right? Dmitri's friend at that time was a guy named William Chamberlain, a conservative columnist for the Wall Street Journal, all right? What happened is that Chamberlain was a kind of informal advisor to Alan Dulles while he was working on the Warren Commission. And his area of specialty was advising Dulles on how to steer the commission away from running into the ties of George and Dmitri to the intelligence community, some of which Chamberlain understood would lead back to Alan Dulles himself. For example, in 1954, a young petroleum lawyer named Herbert Inkin had a meeting with Alan Dulles, all right? And the guy wanted to get into the oil business. Well, what does Dulles do? He refers him to George de Morningchild, okay, who, by the way, Dulles knew by one of his aliases, which was Philip Harbin. All right? Itkin's relationship went on with de Morningchild a number of years. All right? Now, Michael Paine is an heir to both the Forbes and the Cabot families from Massachusetts, all right? Now, I don't have to tell anybody who's has any kind of view of American history that many people who have charted the history of New England will tell you that, you know, those two families are considered the first families in that state.
There is an old saying, Jim, about the what were known as the Boston Brahmins, and it said in Boston, where the Lowells speak only to the Cabots, and the Cabots right. speak only to God. And,
Correct.
And Michael Paine is one of the he is a Cabot.
Right. Okay. And in fact, he was actually related to both of them, okay, through his mother. And so what happens is that we found out through people like Steve Jones, Carol Hewitt, and Barbara LaMonica that he was actually had two trust funds at this time in 1963, one of them from the Forbes family and one of them from the Cabot family, all right? And he was getting monthly checks from both of them, you know, which is, you won't find that in the Warren Report, all right? Now, to give you a hint, of how the commission was about this, all right, is that they got through, and this must have been through Alan Dulles, they got somebody named Frederick Osborne, all right, who had graduated from Princeton with Alan Dulles, and who worked on something called the Crusade for Freedom, a radio effort in Europe, all right, to go ahead and vouch for the goodness and religiosity and the innocence of anything to do in the assassination of President Kennedy with the Paines. Now, what's important about that declaration, and I hope everybody understands what I'm about to say, is that they got that in December of 1963. Let me say that again. They got that declaration from this guy in December of 1963. So my question to Dave and his listenership is, who on earth suspected anything about the Paines in December of 1963?
Well, obviously.
That is just so out there, you know.
Obviously, someone was conducting what I guess we could refer to as a preemptive strike to see
right,
to it.
You're exactly right.
Because you've talked a little bit about Michael Paine and his links to the Cabots and the Forbes and Mr. Osborne. The power elite in the Northeast is part and parcel to the development of the intel community. There is a wonderful book called The Old Boys, The American Elite and the Origins of the CIA. And one of the things that you demonstrate masterfully in Destiny Betrayed is how this elite networks with, or really how the connections of the Paines on both sides of the family grow out of that power elite and their connections.
Right, right. That's one of my main arguments in the book. And so one of the ways we're tipped off to this is the association of Alan Dulles with a woman named Mary Bancroft. Mary Bancroft worked for Alan Dulles in his OSS days. She was one of his agents. They also had a kind of sexual relationship, which cooled off after the war, but they remained friends, all right? Now, Mary Bancroft was a strong friend of Ruth Forbes, which was Michael Paine's mother, all right? As she said in her own terms, she knew the mother of Michael Paine where Oswald stayed. She was Ruth Forbes, a very good friend of mine. When Ruth divorced Michael's father, George Lyman Paine, she married Arthur Young and now became known as Ruth Forbes Young. Ruth and Arthur now became intimates of Mary Bancroft, all right? Arthur Young was one of the inventors of the Bell helicopter, all right? And his father got him a job at a CIA condo at the Franklin Institute, and then he got him a clearance when he moved to Irving to work at that Bell helicopter in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. All right. When asked by the commission what a security clearance was, Michael said he did not know what it was, which I find very hard to believe. All right. Because Ruth was still interested in the Russian language, then the Paines became a part of this Russian expatriate community, all right? And that was their excuse for going ahead and interfacing with them, all right? Now, as I said, Michael Paine's ancestors were from the Boston Brahmins, all right? His uncle, Cameron Forbes, was governor and an ambassador to the Philippines. Prior to his death in 1959, he joined the other side of the Cabot relatives on the board of United Fruit. All right? One of those relatives, Thomas Dudley Cabot, was Michael's cousin. Thomas was actually a former president of United Fruit Company.
United Fruit is deeply involved with U.S. intelligence intrigue in Latin America. And in fact, the dramatis personae that we have looked at and will be looking at in connection with Cuba really coalesced to a large extent in Guatemala when Jacobo Arbenz opposed United Fruit and attempted to institute what was really a very moderate land reform program because he sought to remake Guatemala along the lines of a democratic market-based economy as he felt the U.S. to be. He found out differently. But United Fruit is at the very epicenter of so much of this lethal intrigue in Latin America, and that in turn is inextricably linked with the lethal intrigue that culminates in Dallas.
Right. Now, Thomas's brother, John Cabot, was also in the State Department in the 50s, and was now this one is really interesting, and was exchanging information with Maurice Gatlin about the preparation for the CIA United Fruit overthrow of Arbenz. And by the way, I actually uncovered the letter, and when I was doing this research, from Gatlin to Cabot about this very subject. All right, now, of course, we have to... Gatlin was a good friend of Guy Bannister.
Didn't he actually work for Bannister?
Yeah. He was part of that anti-communist League of the Caribbean. All right? So, I mean, come on. How close can you want to draw the circles?
We should bear in mind
how close they can get.
An earlier citation that you shared with us about Gatlin, and that is his claim with regard to the OAS and De Gaulle and the CIA.
Right. He was supposed to have delivered, I think, $200,000, okay, from the United States to the OAS through a front company called Permandex to go ahead and do away with De Gaulle, all right? Now, in the early 60s, Thomas Cabot was president of Gibraltar Steamship Corporation, which leased uninhabitable land 90 miles off the coast of Honduras named Swan Island. Well, Gibraltar was a CIA front. It owned no ships. It was on that island through the Gibraltar front that David Phillips established Radio Swan, the CIA radio station broadcasting propaganda into Cuba, Mexico, and Central America. During the Bay of Pigs invasion, Radio Swan broadcast secret messages to certain people in the know about that operation. Now, again, none of this is explored by anything that you can find in the Warren Commission, even though Ruth and Michael Payne had the most questions posed to them than anybody else. Walt Brown, a researcher out of the Boston area, actually did some research on this. And I think the figure he came up with was that Ruth and Michael Payne were asked something like 5,000 questions, all right? And out of those 5,000 questions, you won't see any of the stuff that I'm just talking about with Dave here, all right, which I believe is the utmost of the utmost importance to trying to solve this crime, all right? Ruth Payne's family originated from New York before moving to Ohio. Her father, William Avery Hyde, was an executive for Nationwide Insurance. He had worked for the OSS in World War II. He ended up becoming a regional director for AID, the Agency for International Development, in Latin America. And I think Dave knows, and most of his listeners probably know, AID was used many times as a front for the Central Intelligence Agency so they could plant operatives in all types of, you know, third world countries abroad. All right? Now, Ruth told Jim Garrison during a grand jury appearance that her father was on leave to an agency called the International Cooperative Alliance. All right? Now, if you study George de Morenschild, he also traveled with that organization abroad, the ICA. All right? Now, it's important to keep this in mind and never to let go of it, all right, because before Ruth Payne came down to pick up Marina Oswald, all right, She visited her sister, Sylvia Hyde Hoke, in, and there's a debate about this, either in Virginia or Maryland, okay? When Garrison asked her if she could tell him what his sister did for a living because he couldn't find out, she actually said, and by the way, this is on the stand before the grand jury in New Orleans, she said she didn't know. Now, Dave.
Yeah.
Does that sound credible to you?
It sounds like perjury to me.
She spent 2 weeks with her sister, and she didn't find out what she did for living. She didn't know where she went every day when she left in the morning. Okay? All right. Well, it turned out that Sylvia Hyde Hoke worked for the Central Intelligence Agency. She was a professional psychologist involved in top secret projects for them. Okay? And somehow, Ruth never asked her that. All right? All right. So, as I said, I find that very hard to believe. Sylvia's husband, John Hoke, like Ruth's father, worked for, again, AID, all right, the Agency for International Development. All right? Now, Alan Dulles, like I said earlier, kept newspaper reporter William Chamberlain on his staff during his time on the Warren Commission, all right, because Chamberlain was supposed to keep track of how close these associations would come to Dulles. Well, Dulles actually joked about this once, all right, in, I think his name is John Schroeder's biography of Alan Dulles. He writes, Dulles joked in private life that the JFK conspiracy buffs would have field day if they had known he had actually been in Dallas 3 weeks before the assassination, that one of Mary Bancroft's childhood friends had turned out to be a landlady for Marina Oswald. The landlady was a well-known leftist with distant ties to the family of Alger Hiss. This is so interesting that Dulles would joke about that, all right, because he obviously felt that nobody's going to find out about this stuff, all right, or that Ruth Payne's well-known leftist veneer, okay, was not really what it appeared to be.
Jim, we are almost out of time here. I'd like to, when we go for our next interview, to synopsize that. You know, these, and people should remember all of the things that the Paynes did, and Ruth in particular for the Oswalds, the Texas School Book Depository job. This is what that old Alka-Seltzer commercial referred to as some specie meatball. I mean, these are their handlers. And, you know, let's just say if that is a piece loving leftists. They just ain't making those peace-loving leftists like they used to. It is quite remarkable. Plus, you track Ruth's activities on up into the early 1980s. But these people play a very important part in the drama that unfolds in Dallas. And, yeah, you know, Dulles was right. You conspiracy people really did have a field day with this. And I wonder, Jim, being one of those conspiracy people, and I have been accused of being the same thing, why don't you tell some of the other conspiracy people in our audience where they can not only order Destiny Betrayed, but JFK The Evidence Today, and your website and Black Op Radio?
All right. KennedysandKing.com is my website where you'll find a lot of interesting material there, book reviews, research articles, film reviews, etc. You can click through to buy either book, Destiny Betrayed, or the JFK Assassination, The Evidence Today. And I'm a semi-regular on Leno Sanek's show, Black Op Radio, out of Vancouver.
All righty. So those of you who would like to pursue that can do so there. And remember, as we are recording on December 4th of 2018, it is holiday gift giving season, and Destiny Betrayed would make an excellent gift. We will be visiting again with Jim DiEugenio and talking more about the pains. However, this concludes For the Record program number 1037, interview number 7 with Jim DiEugenio about Destiny Betrayed. This is being recorded on December 4th of 2018. For Jim DiEugenio, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.